Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the What You Read Next podcast. In this podcast, your host, Lori Amin, will interview published authors to chat about their work, journey to getting published, and their book recommendations. If you share a passion for books and always looking for your next read, then join us.
Hi.
Welcome to the What You Read podcast. So happy to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a historical romance novelist. Most of my books are set in the 18th century, and they tend to center around strong, sort of feisty, self-actualized women. And they're quite steamy and saucy. Sorry, and I am very feminist.
Yes, and I think it's just like what we need to read, you know? So I love it. So what inspired you to become a writer?
You know, I always sort of wanted to be a writer. From the time I was like a little kid, I would amuse myself on summer vacations by writing stories, often with a romantic arc. And then as I got older and graduated from college, I was sort of thinking about different careers to have, and I ended up in public relations, which is very writing, communications heavy, but got pretty stressed out working in the corporate world after a while and decided to try something different, which led me to romance novels.
Were you always a romance reader, or was it something recently that you decided to write romance novels, or...
I've always been a romance reader. I think I read my first romance when I was 8 or 9. I can't remember exactly, but yeah, I grew up on them. I would go to the library and check out like 20 romance novels every week during summer vacations, and then just hole up in my room and read romance novels. Like, that was my entire youth.
I absolutely adore it. It's a label reader. I'm envious of all the youngins who were sold their romance novels from the moms or went to the library and got them, the Harlequins. And,
yes.
So, that's amazing. So you're a hybrid author. You start as a self-published author, and then you got your first book traditionally published. Let's talk about self-publishing. What was some things you wish you knew when you got started?
Oh, what I wish I knew. I wish that I had known how fun it is to self-publish, I guess. I think when I was sort of thinking through how to become an author, and you know, you, to anyone who's contemplated starting to write books, you do so much research and you talk to lots of people and you see so many stories online, some of them wonderful, some of them horror stories about being trapped in the query dungeon for 2 years, 5 years, 20 years, and stories about things that can happen with publishers and this and that, and you don't really know what to do. And I think when I started, which was around 2014, 2015, to do it seriously, it seemed like the only way to really get a foothold was to try to establish yourself via a traditional publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think that is the case anymore. And I was really apprehensive about trying to do it myself and debuting as indie initially. I got an agent, I queried my book, we submitted it and went through pretty much every romance publisher in town, roundly rejected by them all. Mm-hmm. And that's when I decided to self-publish. So it was really not my first choice. And then when I did it, I just loved it so much. It's just amazing to be able to get your work out there without gatekeepers, and also to be able to sort of look at your books as the full package, not just the text itself, but also the covers and the marketing materials and how you sort of tell a full story with your brand. And I don't know, I really love doing it, perhaps because I have a marketing background. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I wish I had known how fun and energizing it can be, because I was, I think I would have saved myself a lot of time and stress trying to get a foothold with the traditional publisher as a debut, when actually I love self-publishing and it worked out well for me. So
Yeah, someone who's a romance reader, I love, you know, my indie authors a lot. There's like, they just bring a different sass and a different thing to take on to the world. Because you have to think about the overall picture of the book. They're not just thinking about just putting the words on paper. They're thinking about how to market, like you said, like how to market, how to put the cover, like how to share it, and how does it connect to it. And there's a freedom that happens with self-publishing that you don't get when you're traditionally published. Traditional publishing is, there's expectations, you know, to work to earn it that you don't get. You get it self-publishing, you can set your expectations, you can set your own timeline.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just, it's more free and you can take any risks you want. And, you know, publishers, they want you to write good books, and I'm happy working with Harper, but yeah, there are more constraints, you know, there are more cooks in the kitchen.
So. Yeah. So let's talk about how did you end up getting your The Rakers and the Siren series as a traditionally published? What was the journey to get that process?
The journey was, I had already had a bit of a relationship with my publisher because we had submitted my first book, The Duke I Tempted, to them, and they hadn't purchased it, but the editor said some nice things about it, and we ended up having lunch, and my agent wanted to sort of talk about ways we could work together in the future on other potential series, and then the next book, or the next series that I wanted to write, because I was pretty set on Charlotte Street and continuing my indie books, and still am, definitely, like, have not put that on the back burner or anything. But the next thing that I wanted to work on was The Rakes. So when they kind of decided they wanted to do something, I proposed that series and kind of developed the Society of Sirens as an idea for them exclusively. And we sold it to them, and we all lived happily ever after.
I love it. I feel like The Rakes is like such a turning point. Like, it's not just a regular historical. Like, there's feminism, there's dealing with, like, you know, major issues that happen. It's like, it's just, it, I don't know, it's like groundbreaking. That's how it feels.
Oh, thank you.
So, I'm like surprised that it came from a traditional publish, like, you know, because you see that in more indie, like, it's great. It's a great, you know, great stuff that traditional publishers are taking risks, but it's a great risk to take. So thank you.
Well, I'm really impressed that they bought this specific book, because I agree with you. It's got a lot in it. A lot is going on. And I think it was really exciting for me that they were willing to take a risk with that kind of book. And I also thought it was really cool that we were able to put that kind of cover on this kind of book and put it in mass market, which to me is kind of a statement about, you know, romance can be about serious topics, and it already is so, I think it gets short shrift in terms of being considered a book or a genre that is lacking in sort of intellectual grounding or whatever, when it's really not. And so, I don't know, it just seemed like a fun way to slip in some cool stuff into a book that's going to be sold in Walmart with a clench cover, you know?
Yeah. Yes, it is. So now let's talk about your writing. Do you follow Nutland or do you see the short leads? Yeah.
I wish I were more disciplined than I am. I do obviously have deadlines. We all have deadlines. I have deadlines from my publisher. I have my, indie deadlines that I set myself. I then spend a great deal of time not paying any attention at all to those deadlines and then procrastinating in the last couple of weeks before they're due and locking myself in my house and becoming like a Stephen King horror novel, and eventually getting them done and then ignoring the deadline again for the next period of months until I frantically have to produce a book again. So it's a little of both.
I understand. So how do you organize yourself as a writer? How do you keep track of your ideas, inspirations, and characters?
How do I organize myself? Well, not very well, Laura. I tend to have, two books that I'm working on at once, and I tend to be actively working on one of those books. And then the other one, I have a notes file in my phone where I just sort of put ideas in as they come to me. So the book that I'm actively working on is usually, you know, I'm sitting at my laptop every day and trying to get some words on the page in some capacity, or to at least work on the outline or whatever. And then the other one, I'm often researching it. So I'm annotating like historical texts and other research materials. And I don't know, sometimes just not even really thinking about it, but kind of letting it exist in the background and hope that ideas sort of come to me free form. Yeah, but I mean, it's pretty loosey-goosey, to be perfectly honest.
Well, I got a question, because you write historical romans. What is, and you mentioned research, what does the research look like for you?
I love biographies as a source of inspiration. Like the Rake guest I mentioned in the author's note is very heavily inspired by a biography of Mary Wollstonecraft and her daughter Mary Shelley called Romantic Outlaws by Charlotte Gordon, which is a phenomenal book if you are interested. But I find that if you can find a parallel figure in history with some of the characteristics of the character that you hope to write, for instance, Adam Anderson in The Rake Guest, the hero is an architect. So I grabbed a bunch of biographies of 18th century male Scottish architects and worked my way through those, which, not that there's so much detail in the book about, you know, painting the gilt in mansions or which style of, I don't know, Greek versus Roman architecture they're drawing from. Having a little bit of grounding in those details as you just sort of take it in when you're reading a biography really helps, I think, to sort of understand what the texture of that character's life would be. And it saves me having to get sidetracked and ending up wasting 2 days randomly researching what kind of columns would be in the house because I just want to use it. You know what I mean? It sometimes helps me develop a little bit of a sense of the world they might live in without having to go down the rabbit hole of various different aspects of their life.
I love that. I love using memoirs and biographies, just different ways to getting text and getting to see life and getting to see the inner workings of a person to get a sense to make, to build a character, you know, an archetype.
Yeah. I also look at letters. I look at, cultural histories of a certain period. I guess it's a podcast, so you can't see behind me, but I have tomes and tomes and tomes on different aspects of sexuality and culture and race relations and whatever, academic texts on various aspects of the 18th century, particularly in Great Britain, which is where I tend to set my books. So I read those too, but I find that the biographies are the ones that are really the most helpful.
Yeah. That's fascinating. So I got a question. Do you share your work along the way or do you wait till it's completed for others to read?
I do give it to certain people at certain stages. I try not to give it too early because my books are very id driven and sometimes they are so full of nightmares that they are literally traumatic for other people to read. they're quite dark as the finished version, but if you get an early draft, good luck. So I try to take it from that really dark, sort of psychologically potent, but oftentimes disturbing imaginative first draft and refine it for a bit before I subject my core trusted readership to have to deal with it. usually by the time I've been working on a book for a couple of months, I'll have someone who knows my work really well. I have a handful of good friends / colleagues / fellow writers who I trade manuscripts with. And I'll usually try to get someone's opinion or maybe a couple people's opinion on, you know, sort of the first good solid draft, and then refine it, sort of get it to a place where I am comfortable showing my agent. She's usually a good sense of like, is it ready to go to an editor? It's a slow process of not completely traumatizing people over the course of the life of the manuscript.
I love this process so much. Because it's just like, it's an evolution. It's like, it just evolves with time. So.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about the Rakas of Society of Sirens. In the Rakas, you turn a ruined woman trope and a female rake upside down. What was about Mary Wollstonecraft? Wollstonecraft story that led you to write the story.
Well, so Mary Wollstonecraft wrote one of the seminal texts in feminist history, A Vindication of the Rights of Women. And, you know, I've always been interested in her because I had to read that book in my college freshman year humanities class. And it really stuck with me because it struck me as being so not what I had expected. I sort of had this idea of feminism when I was an 18-year-old. That was sort of, I don't know, informed by like the Spice Girls, you know, rah-rah girl power, et cetera. And that is not the tone of Mary's seminal work. It's extremely critical of the ways that women are able to operate in society. She talks a lot about how they are super focused on sort of vain concerns like their looks and money and frivolous pursuits. And her argument is that if they were given an education and afforded certain rights that they don't have, then they would be able to be better wives and mothers. So I was like, wow, that almost strikes me as a misogynist sentiment when I first heard it. And then as I got older and began to understand the world a little bit better, I just couldn't believe how revolutionary it was that this woman who was writing at a time when none of these things existed in society would A, have the presence of mind to call for them in such a concise and fiercely written and just absolutely, I don't know, ahead of its time way. And I also just wanted to know more about her and about like what kind of life would a woman who had these incredibly transgressive views and also such a pointed way of stating them and such a there's a certain slyness in her argument, right? Because she's addressing this book to men who are the people who are able to make the actual changes. So there's a reason why she's not saying like, ladies, you're so awesome, let's get you an education. The ladies don't need to agree with her, like they don't have any power. It's mm-hmm. the men who have the power. And that was like a huge point that I missed the first time I read the book. And it just struck me as being so brilliant and so transgressive and so clever. And I was just fascinated by her and I wanted to know more. So then I started reading her biography and found out that she had this wild life full of like all of these passionate love affairs. And that she was just so transgressive in so many aspects of her life, not just, you know, in writing her intellectual text, but also in the way that she lived and the choices that she made. It was very inspirational to me.
Yeah, I think it was just like, it just led me, for me to be inspired to learn more about her and to learn more about her daughter and like the world, you know, going back generations and just seeing, you know, feminism from that perspective that is so revolutionary at that time. And it's still revolutionary Absolutely. Now, but it's like, that's a big take on, you know, a patriarchy. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So when we meet Serafina, she's getting ready to write her memoir and to mm-hmm. fundraise for an institute, and she's waiting for a lover. In the process of writing her memoir, she faces her baggage. What was it important to uncover Serafina's backstory through the novel? Like her from alcoholism to how she became a ruined woman and all the different things that she uncovered.
Yeah, I think there are probably two things that were going on in my mind there. The first is sort of that aspect of the tautology between the rake and the ruined woman and how they intersect really in romance novels, particularly the ones that I grew up reading, because this book is a little bit of a throwback to those sort of old school romances that I was reading by the handful, by the dozen as a kid. And I was really thinking about both how a rake usually has a traumatic backstory and how a ruined woman often has a sort of miserable life because of the double standard that exists in society about promiscuity and how that has played out over centuries. So when I thought about how Serafina would have arrived at this mantle of rakess, I thought it made sense that perhaps she had been cast as kind of a ruined woman and gone through the trauma of that, of, you know, having her reputation questioned, of losing relationships, of having her future constrained in all the ways that really did happen to women whose, you know, virtue was questioned at that time. And then what if she got so angry that she just defied that whole deal and was like, you know what, never mind, I'm not a ruined woman, I'm a rake. And she claimed the title for herself. So I wanted to do justice to the pain of what might have led to her getting to this place, but also to the freedom of getting there. But I didn't want to lose sight of that double standard, because I think there's a way that I could have written this book that would have been a lot more lighthearted, where she's just a promiscuous woman having a great time, you know, like that is a version of this book that absolutely could have been written. And versions of that book sort of have been written in certain ways. You know, we certainly see characters who are sexually free in some romance novels set in the 18th and 19th century. It's not that it hasn't been done before, but I sort of wanted to do it in a way that felt honest about what the potential stakes of making that kind of choice would be. Because it's a very transgressive choice. And I think we still see today, you know, women who are on the front lines of activist causes, particularly feminist causes, are given a lot of scrutiny and they face a lot of trollery and they often see a lot of hatred in places like the internet or at protests. You know, this is a very, very old concept that remains very fresh, unfortunately. Yeah, I wanted to get to the cost of activism, and I also sort of wanted to play with that rake and ruined woman relationship and sort of poke at it a little bit. So those are sort of on my mind.
I love it. So alcohol is touched upon in this novel. Items are purchased from based on his childhood, and Serafina uses to wage escape. You know, you got this far right. Someone, I'm a child of an alcoholic, so I can see Adam's apprehension really well, and just witnessing, you know, the way alcohol gets at point as a way to escape. How much research did you conduct to get this part, you know, right?
I have an absolute addiction to reading memoirs in general. Like, that's one of my favorite genres of book. And over the course of my life, I have probably read, oh God, like hundreds of addiction memoirs. Like, I love them. I just find them really fascinating. And it's such a, like, that arc of the, you know, the primal addiction and the recovery process and the reckoning with yourself and your truths, I find very powerful just as a narrative. I also have cycles of addiction in my family, so I've seen it firsthand. And I think between reading so many stories of recovery and knowing many people in recovery in my own personal life and sort of growing up in an Irish Catholic family where alcoholism is for sure a thing that we have dealt with for generations. It's not like I had to do that much research. Like, I'm kind of familiar with it very intimately, both in terms of my own story and in hearing other people's intimate stories of recovery. So yeah, it's a topic that I feel pretty familiar with, to be honest.
Familiar, yeah. I thought it was like, it was interesting to see myself in Adam's apprehension. So I was like, oh my gosh, that's how I am. And it's like, and then seeing Serafina, how she uses, you know, because she had a terrible time, like, you know, what happened to her, the trauma, and that's how we just gave. Like, it was just like, oh, it makes sense. Like, it was just like, not, you know, someone who may think it's like a trigger warning. It's like, no, it's just a coping mechanism. That's how they,
of course,
how they go through. So.
Yeah. And also, I mean, there's such a long history in the romance genre of the rake having a very, very, very strange relationship with alcohol. And I say strange because he's like often a very heavy drinker, and often there doesn't seem to be any real consequence. Like, we don't really see him, like, I mean, when I have a hangover, I feel terrible. So I was like, you know what? If Serafina has a drinking problem, there's going to be, like, parts of this book where she feels terrible, and she's going to have to reckon with the numbness that she craves, which is what she's getting from the alcohol, but she's also going to have to reckon with the relationship problems that fall out of her, you know, desire to disappear at times, and the way that that impacts her personality and also her health. So I'm glad that it resonated for you. That means a lot for me.
So Serafina is opposed to marriage, institution of marriage, because of loss of power and of what she loses. Basically, she loses herself when she becomes a wife. Can you expand on this point of view and how Eleanor sort of was a warning sign for Serafina, you know, of what happens to marriage during historical times?
Yeah, well, so basically in Great Britain / the UK, because as the name of the country evolved and its territories evolved, its laws didn't really change until the laws of couverture, which is sort of what is influencing this principle of a woman losing her rights by becoming married. I think that was in effect until like the mid 19th century. You know what? I shouldn't talk about dates because I don't know anything. But anyway, true?
Yeah, but not long time ago.
What I can say with authority is that they were certainly in effect when this book is set, which is 1797, so end of 18th century. And essentially the law was that when a woman married, she basically became, how to phrase it, in terms of her legal rights, she was one person with her husband, but her husband was the person. So basically she was subsumed into his legal identity, which meant that she didn't have her rights to her own property. If she had a job and made a salary, she didn't have the rights to that salary. She couldn't sign contracts in her own name, which often meant she couldn't have things like a bank account without having a co-signer or having her husband sign. If her husband didn't approve of it, she couldn't obtain an education. If they were at odds, she couldn't testify against him in court. She didn't have any custodial rights in her own right to her children. They were his children. You know, think of any legal right that a person has, and basically she didn't have it anymore, because by entering the contract of marriage, she essentially became, you know, her husband's dominion, which is a terrifying concept, in my opinion. I would imagine most of us wouldn't care for that. And yeah, it has been really very heavily on my mind, both in this book and in my Charlotte Street series. The first book in that one, The Duke I Tempted, is about a marriage of convenience. And the heroine has this same just absolute fear of entering a marriage of convenience or any kind of marriage, because she's a businesswoman and she's like, I will be completely screwed if you don't do what you say you're going to do. And that's a point that Serafina's making in this book. She's like, if the best guarantee I have in a marriage is that, you know, if you're good to me, you'll be good to me. If that's the best that the law can do, then it's a bad law. So all of these fears about marriage that she expresses to Adam, and then other things that we see happening in the book, I don't think it's much of a spoiler to say that one of the characters is taken into an asylum by her husband. That was a hot button issue at this time in history. Mary Wollstonecraft, actually, when she was dying, was writing a novel of ideas about this very concept. It was about a woman who was literally in an asylum because her husband had trapped her there after they had a falling out. And that was a thing that could happen. Like, one of the leading intellectuals of her time was writing a book about it. It was that topical. It's a very sobering concept, in my opinion. So, yeah, that's why it's a big theme in the book.
It is. And I think it's just, I don't think it's just, even though it was by the time that's what happened, but I feel like, you know, even now, like, it's fresh in the mind. Like, marriage is not just this equal partnership, like, you know, women didn't have a right to get a bank account not that long ago. Like, a lot of these issues are new, are still fresh, are still relevant in today's society.
Sadly, yes.
Awesome. So let's talk about contraception in 1797.
Let's talk about contraception, baby.
What was it like during this time period? What kind of research did you conduct to get this far? Because we talk about contraception in this book.
We talk a lot about contraception in this book. You know, contraception is an interesting concept because we sort of, there's no authoritative view on how contraception worked at this time. We know that by most estimates, I believe during the 18th century, at least in France, I'm not sure what the figure is in the UK, but France is a Catholic country and was at the time. And on average, a woman had 5 to 6 pregnancies during, a married woman had 5 to 6 pregnancies, which means she was using some form of birth control. Because if you're just having sex and you're a fertile woman and you're getting married in your late teens or early 20s, as people did then, and then remaining sexually active throughout the course of your marriage, the number of pregnancies that could potentially happen is theoretically way higher than 5 to 6. So some form of birth control was certainly happening in most households. But of course, it wasn't the kind of birth control that we practice now. And partly because the science at the time was very foggy on what actually could prevent pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So if you look back during this time, it's so fascinating because almost every book on herbalism, which obviously was one of the major ways that medicine was practiced, particularly among the working class or agrarian people who didn't really have access to, you know, a doctor, a physician in any sort of regular way. A lot of them were just taking herbs that a local herbalist or apothecary made, you know, in their local area. And so many of these texts are just every single thing, sorry, not every single thing, but like a huge majority of the herbs that they're talking about are, it may stop your menses, or it may bring them back on if they suddenly disappear. All these sort of coded ways of talking about how to plan for pregnancy, or how to potentially not carry it through a pregnancy that may have happened in a time that you didn't want it to. So there's that aspect of contraception, you know, certain herbs and certain pills, tinctures, whatever, that people took in order to try to plan their families. And then also condoms have existed since like forever, basically. I think the earliest known record is like 6000 AD or something. Like, they truly go back forever. At this time, they were often made out of a sort of coated linen, I believe, or more commonly animal intestines that had been sort of reshaped to accommodate the human male member. But those were typically used by upper class people, and they were more looked at as a way to stop the spread of disease, mm-hmm. like what we would now call STIs, as opposed to preventing pregnancy. And then of course you have good old fashioned coitus interruptus. So that was used. And obviously there are plenty of ways to have sexual interactions and fun times together intimately without having penetrative sex that may lead to pregnancy between heterosexual partners. But sex education and the knowledge of what actually caused pregnancy was so limited that you just have basically a mess of rumors and maybe this works, maybe that works. So one thing that is sort of alluded to in this book is that Serafina talks to a number of midwives and doctors trying to gather all these different strands of theories. And one thing that led me to think about her doing that is I was just reading, I can't even remember which book it was in, some account of some doctor where he was theorizing about how often he finds that among his male patients who use condoms that they tend to get women pregnant less. Like, he's like piecing it all together. He's like, wait a minute. And I obviously, like, blocking the access of the sperm to the egg is a thing that is not that hard to figure out if you're doing animal husbandry, as people were at this time. So people knew bits and pieces, but a lot of it was just intuitive, and a lot of it was rumor based, and a lot of the science was obviously unreliable. And a lot of these methods are, you know, it may be somewhat helpful to use a pig intestine that you tie around your penis with a string, but probably not as effective as good old fashioned Durex. You know what I mean? Like, you hope for the best. So that's what I was sort of trying to capture in this book. Like, Serafina's trying her best not to get pregnant, but the means that are available to her are almost like witchcraft. It's like, you know, we sprinkle salt over our shoulder and pray.
Yeah, that's how I felt. It was like, it was fascinating to see, like, you know, what they knew, what they didn't knew, what was common knowledge, what was not common knowledge, and then trying to make something out of it, like just trying to make sense of what worked, what doesn't work, and knowing what we know now, like, oh my gosh, you know. But I think you feel the pain. You feel like, you know, like, honestly, you know, what works now is very different from what was happening in 1797. So.
For sure.
So what can we expect about book two of the Society of Sirens, Society of Sirens series?
So the next book is going to be Cornelia's book, and Cornelia is a painter. So the plot will be heavily centered around her art and the next phase in her League of, sorry, in the Society of Sirens, she's one of the three sirens, and they're all in league together to raise money to form an institute for women's equality. So Serafina in the first book is writing a memoir to sell that sort of capitalizes on her notorious reputation. And then Cornelia is a political portraitist in the sense that she paints portraits of people in order to sort of poke at the political structure and basically cause ire in order to draw attention to topics that she's trying to advocate for. So she'll be doing a lot of that in the next book, but it's also, from a romance perspective, going to be a house party trope, because that's one of my favorite romance tropes. So it'll be like art and free love and bed hopping and justice in the English countryside.
I love it. And are you working on a Charlotte series book?
Yeah. So the next book in that series will be called The Rogue I Ravished, and it'll probably be out next year. I'm outlining it. I haven't actually started writing it yet, but it will be Elena Brearley, who is the whipping governess at the center of the series, will be the heroine, and it will be kind of a play on the girlfriend experience. I'm excited about that one.
That looks so good. Oh my gosh. So now let's go to a round of book recommendations. This is an opportunity for you to share with our audience what they should read next. So what is your favorite genre?
Well, aside from romance, which I have loved since childhood, as we've discussed, I really love memoirs, as I mentioned. And then I also love reading domestic fiction, like those sort of literary books where it's like everyone is in the same family and they all live in a house and nothing happens. Love it.
I love this. So who are your favorite authors?
Oh, so I knew you were gonna ask me this, and I was trying so hard to think of an answer, but I don't know if I have, like, it's just so hard to narrow it down. I do think I have three favorite authors in romance, though. So I will tell you those. So okay. I'd say my number one is Alexis Hall, who writes amazing contemporary queer romances that are just beautifully written and, like, gorgeously imagined. And the characters just jump off the page. The writing is just amazing. Love his books. And then I'm obsessed with Cecilia Grant, who is a historical romance novelist who writes, I think they're pretty much all Regency set. But they're just like, it's almost like she's doing Jane Austen. They're so funny and so minutely observed. And the romance tropes are so beautifully done and so sort of respectfully observed in terms of the tradition of the genre, but so fresh, and she's just an incredible writer. So I love everything she's written. And then I'm obsessed with Laura Kinsale, particularly her masterpiece Flowers from the Storm, which is my favorite romance novel ever. But I think she's just a stone cold genius who writes incredible characters. Like, her prose is beautiful, her research is, I don't even know how she does it. She's just a genius. So top three romance authors. I can do that much.
I love it. And this is perfect. What has been a book you read this past year that you love?
I really loved a memoir called In the Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado. Mm-hmm. You heard of it? It's a memoir of her. It's sort of a domestic abuse memoir, which sounds really depressing, but it's actually sort of a survival memoir as well, where she sort of talks about how she got into this tumultuous relationship with her former girlfriend. And each chapter is basically a trope from literature. So some of it, like, she has one chapter that's like a choose your own adventure book, where she's telling about a chapter in her relationship with this woman, but it reads as like a lighthearted choose your own adventure book. I don't know. It's an incredible, incredible memoir. I loved it so much. Good read. Obviously content warning for spousal abuse and manipulation. And I would definitely read the content warnings on that one, but it's a beautiful book.
I may pick that one up. So I love memoirs. So, all right. So tell us where we can find you online.
You can find me online on Instagram. I am at Scarlett Peckham. I love to make pretty little graphics for my book, so there's plenty of that there. On Twitter, I sometimes hang out at Scarlett Peckham as well. My website is www.scarlettpeckham.com, and you can find my books on all the retailers.
Thank you, Scarlett, for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This was delightful.
If you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to share with friends, subscribe, or rate and review the show. This is the easiest way to support this podcast. Want to join a romance-loving community? Want weekly book recommendations, monthly author Q&As, and book recommendation meetups? Make new friends? Then join our Patreon community. To sign up, please follow the links in the show notes. What to Read Next podcast is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more podcasts to love on frolic.media/podcasts. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What to Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatyourreadnextblog.com/sponsorships to learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.